I mean, let's see if we have anything to talk about.
Start the game already!
I've yet to go shopping.
Uh-oh. Shane is going without pants again this episode.
Which means that... Oof.
Oh, wow.
Today, I'm into the Sargento tequila that came back from Mexico with my mother after vacation.
You sure it's tequila and it's not just a really long flight? I've never been a fan of tequila.
Ooh, it's potent.
So I have a beer that I'm not ashamed to say that I may not actually be able to pronounce. It's Hackerpforr, which is from Germany. It's a Münchner Gold. Münchner? I have no idea. Anyway, it's beer.
I'm going to ruin this tequila by mixing it with Pepsi Zero Sugar Lime.
I don't think you can ruin tequila. I think you ruin tequila by just having tequila.
My options were limited. It was either this or like a weird Mexican coffee liqueur that was not like Kahlua or anything like that. It was like very, very runny looking and looked kind of unfortunate.
Oh. Well, I did actually go shopping. So I have now a selection of beers and I have a bottle of butter schnapps.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which has sort of tippled into my coffee in the mornings on the weekends, but otherwise hasn't been touched much.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So how have you been?
Pretty good. I took apart and sort of did up my golf clubs because I had some rattling things around inside of them. You know, absolutely riveting content for everyone who doesn't play golf, but for me back in the day, and this was like it would 2001, 2002, somewhere around there. I needed a new set of golf clubs and I couldn't afford them. So I ordered the parts and I assembled them myself. And I'm still playing with them cause like they're awesome and I love them, but you know, little bits and pieces of them come loose inside and start rattling around. You got to take them apart and redo them. You got to replace the grips at least every year, yada, yada, yada. And during COVID, golf took off as a hobby, so everything is more expensive now, like everything else. They say it's a rich man's game, which is why I haven't really gotten that involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
Very lucky. My local golf course is very, very cheap and also very nice.
It's been so long since I've played that in moving stuff around in this room, which was like half of it is storage, I have two hand carts for carrying around golf bags that I am literally just going to pitch.
Yeah. Nobody wants them anymore. Two wheelers?
Yep.
Yeah. No, nobody uses those anymore. It's funny, you know, because that like two wheeled golf carts existed for 100 years and then somebody went, hey, why don't we put a third wheel on there? And suddenly it was like, oh my God. And now they all have three wheels, which they always should have because it just makes sense. Well, I mean, why not?
I don't know what to tell you, man. I think one of them actually is a three-wheel cart, but still, I'm just going to pitch it. They haven't had a bag strapped to them in a decade. Mm. In that decade, I think I've hit a driving range once.
Not your passion.
No, not really. And that's fine.
Yeah, it's totally fine. I get upset with people who are like, oh, we should just turn all of golf courses into housing developments, which in some cases, you know what, is not a bad idea. But in other cases, it's like it's the only green space in your town, right? Like, is it ideal green space? No, it's not. It should be a park. But yeah, we've already covered enough of the world in pavement. Let's not cover any more of it in pavement and concrete.
I suppose. It's green space available as a rule to the people who need it the least.
That's not unfair. I mean, they do it in the UK. They do it a lot better. Like St. Andrews, which is like the, you know, the old course that everybody talks about, is on Sundays. You can't play golf there because it is literally a public park. And I think that's a great use of the space. Like our course here doesn't have the security involved in the golf courses. Somebody will go, "Hey, are they supposed to be here?" And they're not hurting anybody. So, you know, and there's walking trails all around it and whatnot. So I do think that golf courses in deserts are dumb, right? Yes. Like that's dumb. You know, somewhere where, hey, grass just grows on its own. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, covering it in pesticides and stuff is not a great idea.
We're worried about how much of the Colorado River can actually make it down to the southern states and Mexico. And let's just divert some of it to irrigate this Las Vegas. Now, I have to say, I'm being unfair because Las Vegas is a city in the middle of the desert, is one of the most efficient and economical cities when it comes to water usage and conservation in the world.
They reuse a lot.
They've put a lot of work into it. Good for them. The golf courses.
Yeah. Las Vegas was just a bad idea. I mean, we can all agree on that, right?
I saw something the other day, and I wish I could dig it up, that was basically describing Las Vegas in terms of like a fantasy city.
Okay.
Basically, it is this magical city in the middle of a desert surrounded by inhospitable territory that somehow this beacon of life and it's devoted entirely to luxury and entertainment and splendor. And it's like, that's a fucking D&D town.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm not entirely sure how you explain away the old ladies in diapers who are sitting there terminally attached to a slot machine just waiting for, you know, anything nice to happen.
I think you can make it work.
Maybe so.
Basically, their life force is what fuels this fantasy city, right?
Oh, like, I see.
They're harvesting their life force. And
I mean, that's darkly true. You know.
I'll dig that up and kick it. Yeah, it was quite funny. I'm not doing it justice.
I read something this week, too, that I was thinking about saving, and then I realized that I don't actually have a Reddit account logged in on my new phone, and I'm like, I'm not going to dig up my username and password. I don't care to post ever, because all that happens is you get dogpiled from every direction. There was a post about somebody who went in to play Baldur's Gate 3 blind, having never played D&D and knowing nothing about it, and he got to the goblin camp, and he's like, I don't understand. I just can't, I try and attack from stealth. I try and attack from afar. I try and like lure the goblins across the bridge, and I just keep getting wiped out every time. And there's this big long description of how like the tactical approach to attacking the goblin camp is just so stupid. And who set up this encounter? It's so dumb. And then edit. Oh my God, you can talk to them. Right. And it's such a video game thing, right? Because it's like, I mean, you sent me a link to Unreal Tournament today, and I'm like, that's the games that we sort of, that's the trope, right? If you see something moving, it's an enemy, kill it, right? That's how video games work. And the idea that, okay, well, you're supposed to talk to them first and maybe you can fool them into not fighting you, just would never cross your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so funny reading through, because then it was like edit after edit after edit after edit of like, oh my God, you can do what now? You can do thing? There's other ways in. You can jump down there. You can do what now? You can do things in different order.
Wait till you actually play tabletop. It'll blow your fucking mind.
You know what? I have something to say about tabletop. I made some notes in the show doc, but I mean, they were more or less just humorous digs. But there was something I was thinking about, like, hey, we should do Dungeons and Dragons hot takes. And here's my hot take. Fourth edition is a good game.
We talked about fourth edition before, and I think that was our consensus. It's like, it's a better game.
Yes.
You know, capital G game than fifth edition. It is a less fun tabletop collaborative experience than fifth edition.
And I think that there's no reason why it couldn't be, but the whole, I was thinking about it from the point of view of Baldur's Gate 3 and the fact that Larian has basically said, yeah, we're walking away from Dungeons & Dragons because Hasbro, I'm reading between the lines here. They didn't actually say this, but between the lines, Hasbro are dicks.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, it's a gamble. I read that news too, and my interpretation of it was a couple of things. One, they're trying to do some interesting stuff in terms of combat, and they've said that, and they've found the fifth edition system limiting.
Yes, and you would. And this is where I think if you were to try and make a video game of Dungeons & Dragons, 4th edition is perfect because it's reasonably well-balanced. There's nothing out of the ordinary. It's really accessible to people who have done that kind of video gamey thing before where it's like, okay, well, this is intuitive. This is how it works. And I really miss, and I think I've said this before too, the older editions of Dungeons & Dragons, like 1st edition and 2nd edition, which were janky as hell. Like, they're terrible games. If you sit down with a group of people and go, this is, we're going to play exactly by the rules, the game isn't fun, right? Like, it's horrible. You need a human referee because you need to be able to say, okay, this rule doesn't make sense. We're going to do it this way instead because of circumstances or whatever. But fourth edition, you can just go, yeah, play it rules as written, and it's fine. It's just a lot of stuff to keep track of. And fifth edition is a good blend of those things, I think, where you can go really, really simple on the rules. You still need like a person to smooth out some of the rough edges, but things are reasonably balanced-ish.
Yeah. The other thing with Larian, I think, is when they went into Baldur's Gate 3, they said, we're not interested in sharing the profit. We're not interested in a publisher that's going to be steering us. We want to do this on our own. So they paid full pop for the license and basically told Hasbro, I mean, obviously there's sort of a partnership there, but like you have no say in how this game works.
Right.
We've purchased the rights to use it. We're going to make our game. And with the success that they've had with Baldur's Gate 3, I think Larian is probably banking on the fact that they're a big enough name now that they can do it without the license. I think they're probably doing what BioWare did, making the jump from Knights of the Old Republic to Mass Effect.
Yeah. Right?
Where it's like, okay, we could continue to pay for licensing rights to Star Wars, or we've made a big enough name for ourselves with all of the shit that we've done. Let's make our own IP. Let's keep all the profits. Let's build something that allows us to do the things that we want to do and explore the things that we want to explore. If they'd had just come off of like Divinity Original Sin 2, which was, I haven't finished it, but it was a great game, and I'm going to go back and play through it again. Without Baldur's Gate 3, I don't think the Larian name meant enough mainstream to guarantee success for their next game when they tried to do something on their own. And I think with what happened with Baldur's Gate 3, and I think everybody would admit that it is...
It's good.
Well, it's fantastic, but it is also an unexpected success.
An unexpected level of success, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think it's any kind of a surprise that it was actually successful.
No, but, you know, even looking at the old Baldur's Gate games, right, that BioWare did, they appealed to a niche.
Did I don't think BioWare did the Baldur's Gate games. They did Neverwinter Nights. I don't think they did Baldur's Gate.
Was it Black Isle?
I think so.
I want to say maybe they were a publisher on it or something. Anyways, the first two games were successful for people that played that kind of game that were into CRPGs, right? Like if you were playing Wizardry and you were playing Heroes of Might and Magic and you were playing, you know, that was your thing, those games were your jam. But I don't think that they, and even Neverwinter Nights, achieved that sort of mainstream playership and presence of mind that Baldur's Gate 3 has. I think Knights of the Old Republic got close because they could lean on the Star Wars IP, and they crafted between them and Obsidian what many people at the time considered two of the best games made. And then they said, now we're going to do Mass Effect.
Knights of the Old Republic 2 is the very first video game that I ever actually finished. It might be one of the very few that I have actually... Oh, no, maybe it wasn't the first one. I think the first one I finished was... it was an Amiga game that I played where you went into... you went through a portal into another world and you met a big alien dude. The only thing I can remember from it is Mites of Rubar. Because you never actually got translations of what the aliens were saying. Oh, what was it called? Anyway, it looks like, sorry, I stand corrected. It looks like BioWare actually was one of the developers on the original Baldur's Gate. Yeah, they were. And then Black Isle.
Did Icewind Dale, I think.
Well, they did two. I don't, they weren't involved. It looks like they weren't involved in Baldur's Gate 2.
Okay. And that sort of was their MO at the time. Like the same thing happened with Knights of the Old Republic. They did the first one and then had Obsidian come in and craft, which I would argue is the better game if it had been allowed to be finished. Have you actually played through the game with the content restoration mod?
Which game, sorry?
Knights of the Old Republic 2.
No.
Okay. Put it on your radar as something to try at some point. Because so much of that game got cut. Like, it was basically developed and rushed out in a year. And what came out was amazingly good, but there was a lot of stuff that was cut just because they didn't have time to finish it.
There were a lot of doors that seemed like they should open and they didn't. I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that is the definitive way to play it. Like, fans have restored and, to the best of their ability, finished the content, sort of in the same vein that Vampire the Masquerade kind of had that cult following after the developer folded. And fans to this day are still creating patches for that game to improve the play performance.
Temple of Elemental Evil was like that too.
Yeah.
Oh, I hated that game. The very first encounter you had was three giant frogs. I hated it. Blah.
You mentioned that I sent you a link this morning.
Yes. And then I went and watched part of the video, and I was 20 minutes into this, I don't know, 3 or 4 hour retrospective of Unreal Tournament before I realized, you know what? Unreal Tournament was awesome, but it does not deserve this much in-depth analysis. Mm. So let's do a really in-depth analysis of Unreal Tournament and our experiences with it.
The link that I kicked him, it was the LGR video for the 20th anniversary of the release of Unreal Tournament 2004, which we didn't play a lot. In our LAN party days, we tried to get into the 2003, which was not great. And then 2004 was basically 2003 done properly, and it was okay.
It was a fine game. It just wasn't, like, it was never, Unreal Tournament was never my thing, right? My fast twitch muscles are basically on,
they never existed.
Yeah, they're on Siesta all the time, right? I'm much more of a, okay, let's plan this out and then execute the plan. And in the meantime, it's, yeah.
Which is where Ghost Recon came in.
Yeah.
But Unreal Tournament was our first real LAN party game with that crew. We've mentioned it before. We worked in a call center, and there was a big portion of us that all worked nights and spent a lot of time while working overnights playing Unreal Tournament because it would run on a potato, like, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We had these shitty, like, Dell Optiplexes with, like, Intel 810E chipsets, integrated video.
G110s, I think?
Maybe, yeah. They were, you know, like, shared memory, 4 megs RAM. We were playing at times at, like, 320 by 240 resolution just to get the frame rate that we wanted on those. But Unreal Tournament would do it. Like, it'd run in software rendering mode or OpenGL, or, like, it was of the time where they had to put the work into to making it work for different video cards. And that became our game. And there were a few people in our circle that were fantastic at it.
Really, really unreal good, honestly. You know, like, you see the memes and the jokes about, like, 360 no-scope headshot from across the map. And there were people who were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, my original screen name was Cannon Fodder because literally I would spawn and die. If I got two steps, I considered that a win.
Mm-hmm. I've thought about that game a little bit recently, and I think I figured out the problem for you. I mean, we put you in a situation that you just weren't, you know, well-suited for.
It's just not my thing.
But, you know, we would crank the speed up to 120%, 125% and play at that. But I think you were trying to play the game like a shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And the game, for me, I played it almost like a rhythm game. Like, you learn the maps, you learn, like, I wasn't aiming at anybody half the time, right? It's like, I'm walking around, I find a route. There's, you know, and I'm playing the percentages. There's 35% chance that somebody's going to be walking around that corner. I'm going to lob a grenade, or like the flat cannon alternate fire thing. We're talking about UT-99 now. Yeah. And 50% of the time I wouldn't hit anybody because there wouldn't be anybody there. But that would be the other 50% of the time. It's you getting ready to walk around the corner. You barely get a chance to even see me and start to aim by the time you've already caught a flak shell in the face.
Over and over and over again.
Like, it was the opposite of Ghost Recon. And those two games, we've talked about them before, ruined first-person shooters for me. And I think that's why we hated Unreal Tournament 2004 so much.
Yeah.
Because it sat in that middle ground in between. You know, it was obviously faster than, like, Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter, which we hated. It was faster than
Raven
stuff
Shield.
Like Halo and stuff like that. But we either had to play that super slow tactical shit, like the original Ghost Recon and the expansions, or the shit that was just, you know, you're sweating 5 minutes into it. Balls out Twitch Unreal Tournament 99 at 120%. Anything that fell in the middle was either too slow or not slow enough.
Yeah.
I still feel that way to this day.
There's a weird thing where, like, the speed and every game, I think, has a rhythm to it. Mm-hmm. It's actually how I've improved at golf over the years, is finding the actual rhythm of how it's supposed to work. But I think every game has its own, like, just its own, I don't know, spirit, whatever, soul, rhythm, mm-hmm. something. But if it doesn't match what you're expecting, right, there's a dissonance, and then it's unpleasant. And almost everything other than those two games, as far as shooters goes, have just fallen flat. Mm-hmm. There's something to be said too for games that, because back in my day, when give me five bees for a quarter, we'd say, uphill both ways in the snow, father's pajamas, yada yada yada. All right, back then there was a lot more focus on, like, what kind of game is it? Right? Like, what does the game do? What is the game about? And then you would sort of add graphics on top of that. Now, obviously, there was a focus on making the graphics better, but now Call of Duty? The last Call of Duty I played, I can't remember which one it was. It was a few years ago, but it really was, this isn't a game. This is a movie where occasionally I press A to continue. Right, it's like, here's a cutscene, and it's like, this is literally a 15-minute movie, mm-hmm. and then I get to go through, like, a section of road about 100 yards long where I have to shoot three people and avoid a somebody lobbing grenades at me or a car that's running by, and then there's another 15-minute movie. Like, what's the point? Well, just show me a movie or give me a game, one or the other. Right, cutscenes are fine, like in between acts or whatever, or every so often there's a, you know, I don't know, an interlude of this is what the enemy's doing or what have you. But the focus or the balance between those two things disappeared or went vastly in the other direction. How many cutscenes are there in Unreal Tournament 99?
I mean, I guess technically speaking, there's the opening sequence as the theme's playing until you hit escape to get to the menu. And if you play through the campaign, there's an intro to that, and that's basically it.
Yeah, that's it. And that game had legs.
We played it for a long, long time. I still fire it up maybe once or twice a year.
I don't. I hate it.
Do you hate it, or just the memories associated with it now?
It's funny. It occupies a very strange nostalgia niche for me, where, like, I enjoy it because, first of all, my wife and I met playing that game. I mean, we had met before that in the call center, but, like, that's one of the things that we sort of bonded over is that, and it's bizarre. She can't play those games now because she gets vertigo too bad. Mm-hmm. Because the screens are too big now. She needs, like, literally a 15-inch 640 by 480 monitor in order to play a first-person shooter. So there's a weird nostalgia niche. Like, I enjoy the game. I like the idea of the game. I'm just so bad at it that I can't play it with other people. right? I'm just bad. And that's fine. It's just, it's not my thing.
Now, one of the things that we didn't do, and we mentioned this when we were talking today, is like we played Deathmatch. So it was literally worst case scenario for you. Everybody else that's playing this game right now is actively trying to kill you.
Yep.
You are the low hanging fruit.
Yep.
You're the free space on the bingo board.
Yep. There was, yeah, you look at, you get the sort of kill count and death count at the end of the thing, and it'd be like the winner has 75 kills and I have 74 deaths. And one kill, and I got that because I accidentally lobbed a grenade at somebody.
We never really, I think we did a little bit of capture the flag, but there's so many different modes in that game, and we really didn't explore them too much. It'd be interesting for us to like do a retro LAN party and throw that game into the mix, but avoid deathmatch.
Yeah. Playing those kinds of things as a team is a little bit more interesting too. And I think that's definitely a more modern sort of approach to the game. Like there's not a lot of games that I see anymore where it's, you know, you against everybody, mm-hmm. you know, other than probably the Nintendo Brawler game. Out of This World was the Amiga game that I played and finished. And the only reason I finished it was because it was about 7 minutes long. Like it was a side scroller, and I think it had 7 or 10 screens or something.
Now it's worth mentioning that Unreal Tournament was the game that sort of filled the space when not everybody was like there yet. You know, we'd start yep. with that, people would filter in, so somebody'd help somebody carry their computer and help them get set up, and it'd be like this hour, 2 hours while 5, 6, 7, 8, like you couldn't have had teams the way we were playing it. When we were playing it,
nope,
because people were dropping in, dropping out, and then we would get to now everybody's here, everybody's playing, and then we'd switch. That would be when Ghost Recon would come on. That'd be when Age of Empires 2, Need for Speed Porsche.
Well, hang on a second now. Age of Empires didn't come out until everybody was basically asleep.
Yeah, okay.
It was the just one more game, and here's a 6 hour RTS or whatever.
Fair. It depended on the size of the LAN party. If it was one of our like 8-person LAN parties, it came out a little bit earlier.
Yeah, that's true.
It was definitely for the bigger LAN parties, one of those games that came out as people were starting to leave.
Yeah.
The diehards would be like, okay, the rookies are going home. We got another 20 hours left in us at least. Start the game already.
Oh my God. I cannot stay awake anymore in any given day as long as we would play Age of Empires at our old LAN parties. Like the game that we would play to finish out the night is now longer than my actual awake time.
Now the reason I brought up Unreal Tournament earlier, as I mentioned, they were celebrating their 20th anniversary of Unreal Tournament 2004, which makes it 25 years about until UT99 came out. How do you feel about that? It makes me feel old.
Well, dude, I'm going to be 50 next week, so I, by default, feel old.
You know when you get old, like now? Now is the time when we're supposed to be. Things back in my day were so much better, and this newfangled shit just get off my lawn, shouting at the clouds, right? But Unreal Tournament 99 was the game we were old men about then, because it was 2003, 2004.
Yeah.
Fuck this shit. My Unreal Tournament, so much better.
Yeah, but I mean, there were also people who, do you remember? you can't talk about this stuff without bringing out the member berries. Do you remember like Doom and Castle Wolfenstein? And there was one that I had for my Commodore 64 that you were making your way down a pyramid, and it was literally just you'd look at two posts and you make a 90 degree turn to the left, you'd be looking at two different posts, and you had like three choices. You could go forward, left, or right, and it was a first person shooter, finger quotes. So I remember thinking that, because like Doom was awesome, and then there was of course like Duke Nukem when it went from a side scroller to a first person shooter. It was the age of the first person shooter. And like Unreal Tournament was, it was a little bit different from all of them, because all of the others tried to give you some kind of a, I mean, Unreal Tournament had a story, I guess, but I mean, it was very much a, yeah, there's a single player mode, but whatever. like single player mode in Unreal Tournament 99 was, all right, fire up some bots, right? Put in some NPCs that you can shoot and play deathmatch. So it was a little bit like a little bit different in that it was like it was a tournament, right? So it had that sort of competitive feel. I don't know, thinking back on like there are games, you know what, I was playing Far Cry there last year, the year before, and I mean Far Cry 5, I think it was, whatever one they gave away for free a couple of years ago, and it was a great game. Like it was a lot of fun. It was too long. Mm-hmm. And to see what first person shooters are now, I don't think anyone would have the appetite for Unreal Tournament 99. So I feel like it's a little bit of a lost gem.
Sure. You know, and it was also special in its time. Like we tried Quake 3 Arena 2, right?
Yeah.
We all played like Quake 2, I'm sure at some point, but we went back and forth. It was like, let's try Unreal Tournament. Let's try Quake 3. They released that online version of Quake 3 later. That was not like a re-release, but it was like, oh, hey, remember this game you used to play at LAN parties? Well, now you can play it online basically through a browser. And we tried that, and it was just like, it's not Unreal Tournament.
Yeah.
Hot take, Ben. Unreal Tournament was our sports game, not our first-person shooter.
Yeah, it very much was. It was funny because that video that you sent, one of the major comparisons was that 2003 had a very big sports theme, right? Like it's football, basically. One of my very favorite games for the Amiga was called Speedball 2. And it was basically football, except it's like a cross between football and is it netball? The one where the women's teams don't move at all. Like if you're holding the ball, you're not allowed to move. It's not important. It's like a sort of a handball where you sort of throw the ball around. And Speedball 2 was basically that with a steel ball. Right. And one of the things that you could do was kill your opponents. Right. And Unreal Tournament feels a lot like that game where it's not like it really doesn't feel like violence. It feels like sports. Right. You may as well be playing like it has a lot. It's a lot some more similar feel to what's our national sport?
Lacrosse.
Like it has that kind of a feeling, only instead of throwing a ball, you're basically, you know, shooting at people.
Yeah.
You know, I remember too, at the time, Penny Arcade was doing a lot of comics about the Instagib mod. You know, it's Capture the Flag, I think. But you only got the plasma rifle? Like that was it, but one shot killed you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I never played it because I mean, everything was an Instagib for me anyway. So I was always playing Instagib. But I remember the comics. They were good.
The other thing worth mentioning about that style of game that just doesn't apply anymore in first-person shooters is that you could play it for 15 minutes, be satisfied, and turn it off.
Yep.
You know, I think the only recent, and this is not a new game, but the only recent game that's really felt that way to me is Rocket League.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, did I tell you my story about Rocket League? I think I did. We started playing Rocket League, and it's another game that you're much better at than I am. And that's fine. You know what? I still enjoy it. Even when I'm terrible at it, it's still a lot of fun. But I logged on one day to think, okay, I'm going to get some practice. So the next time we play, I'm not a total scrub.
Mm-hmm.
So I jump in and I'm like, you know, my rating is like, you know, level 2 newbie. I still have training wheels on my car, and I'm playing around and I suck. Right. And I'm doing my best, but whatever. Right. And at the end of every game, I'm like, yeah, okay, play again. Right. Cause I don't care. I'm just here to practice. Right. I just want to play. And I got hooked up with this teammate at one point who spent the entire game typing at me, telling me how I suck and I need to quit. You suck. You need to quit. Stop. Stop playing again. You need to quit. Quit. Stop. And at the end of every game, I'm like, play again. And he's like, he also hits play again, right? Like you have there's a mode where like you say, like, let's keep the same teams and play again. And he keeps selecting, keep the same team, and then telling me I suck and that I need to leave. And I'm like, why don't you leave? Right. And I'm totally not interacting with this person at all. Like, I'm not saying anything. I'm still trying to play the game. But I'm laughing my ass off thinking like, this is like, you're trying really hard to troll me here and it's just not working. Like, you think that I'm a failure at this game, but I have to say you're a bigger failure at trolling than I am a failure at this game. And I am a failure at this game. Oh man, that was years ago. And it lives rent free in my head. Just thinking like, there's this guy and he's getting ready to throw his controller at the screen because he's so angry. And I'm like, all you have to do is just not push the button. It's only him and me that are pushing play again. So he and I keep getting matched up as teammates and playing against a new team every time. I'm like, dude, you can just leave. You can just opt out.
Yeah. Yeah, I've stopped taking. I mean, I don't play a lot of multiplayer games just because there are some games that, like, the nice thing about Rocket League is the interactions are so limited, right?
Yes.
You can't just, you know, type a big ass message, or at least you couldn't. I haven't played it in forever, but, you know, you had sort of pre, almost like Age of Empires taunts, right? Where it's like, you've got so many things that you can say. Yes, there was some that suggested, you know, negative, but whatever.
Yeah. The world is full of negative people, and I got no patience for it anymore.
I've learned that no matter how good I think I am at any game, I am ass. Do you remember? We had a few years there where we were taking our Ghost Recon real seriously, and we started a clan.
Oh my God,
yes. We practiced for, I don't know, a couple of months on weekends, and then we're like, okay, now we're going to play. And we started playing some online multiplayer, and I think, like, literally the second team we matched up against, the second was this clan out of Quebec.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure they were cheating.
I'm certain they were cheating.
But the experience was just so incredibly humbling and such a reminder that, oh no, you guys will never be good.
Yeah.
You might be good relative to each other sometimes, but you'll never be good.
Yeah. Ghost Recon had this sort of follow a player once you're dead or out of spawns or whatever. And we got into a game where we were mixed with them. Like, it wasn't us against them. It was a sort of a cross mix. And I was ghosting one of their players, and they were sitting in the basement following the progress of another player through several walls. Right. Like, they were aimed at the player and then they'd strafe, and they were aimed at the player and they would strafe, and then they would pop out where they were visible and shoot them immediately. So, yeah, they were definitely cheating. But I mean, that's online gaming for you. Someone somewhere is going to cheat. Right. It is what it is. I don't blame them. I really don't. If that's how they got enjoyment, carry on. I mean, you're not making money on it. You're not stealing my money by it. Whatever.
Before we get back to some actual table talk, you mentioned that you'd started playing Horizon Forbidden West. You've cheated. It's not your birthday yet. You're not supposed to be playing this game. How's that going?
I didn't get very far. There's a sort of an introductory video on YouTube, and if you've seen it, I haven't gotten that far yet. I've gotten so far as to get through the bits of the tutorial where they teach you this button does this, and this is how you climb things. I had forgotten how frustrating some of the control scheme is when you're not into it a lot. Because when I played Horizon Zero Dawn, I basically consumed the whole thing in a fevered rush. So by the time I got to the end of it, I was really accustomed to the control scheme, which is a little bit different because it's a port from a console. And I'm playing with a keyboard and mouse because I can't do, it's third person, but like the first person kind of movement with a controller doesn't make sense to me, right? I just can't do it. So, and with keyboard and mouse, it's not bad. It's just a little bit different from everything else. And I was thinking about this too while I was playing it, because I loaded up Baldur's Gate, the original, the enhanced edition, because it was on sale for like $2.35 or something. And I thought, I wonder how, this was back when every single game had its own like sort of set of controls. And this is how we're going to control things in this game. And then the same sort of publisher, developer, or whatever would make another game that like Baldur's Gate 2. And here's how we're going to do the controls on this one. And it's different. Like, why is it different? Like, you literally flip two or three keys around just to confuse everybody. Why?
It definitely took the industry a while to figure out some standards. And some developers went out of their way to avoid anything resembling a standard for a while. Do you remember playing games that would come with like a keyboard condom?
Yes.
You would just slip on top of your keyboard and it'd have all the like labels for.
Yes. Or like, remember the WordPerfect templates?
Mm-hmm.
If you hit Control Shift M 32957 and then hit Enter and Alt, the text will turn green, and that means that it's bold and italicized.
Back when games didn't allow you to customize the keybinds.
Oh my god, yes.
You know, here it is. WASD wasn't a thing for movement, right? Like, so you're over here with arrows, you're contorting your body into a weird shape.
Yep. The rhythm of a lot of games was slower too, which I appreciated, and I still do. Like, there's some amount of sort of frenetic movement that appeals to some people.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't always have to have everything be epic and epically fast and ridiculous and frenetic all the time either.
Except, like me, unless it goes far enough to one extreme or the other, you tend not to like it.
Yeah. I mean, you have, well, there's a sweet spot, right? And I think it's probably an awful lot like standing waves, right? Where there's certain rhythms that will match even if they are in between. But you have to find that happy medium. And it would be nice if you could, play a game at your own rhythm and your own pace. Right. And for me, Baldur's Gate 3 actually kind of hit that happy medium where I can do, right. And there's been a few times when I've, in one of my 17 playthroughs of Act 1, where I've done everything basically in real time, you know, or as reasonably fast as it's like, okay, there is time pressure and I have to make decisions. I can't go like, what spells do I have? What can I do? How is this going to, it's like, it's my turn. I have to make a decision. Right. And there's, it's enjoyable to do that. Did you play much of Neverwinter Nights?
I mean, I haven't started playing it again since I bought it on the Steam sale, but back in the day, I played the original. I played Neverwinter Nights 2 a fair bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because Neverwinter Nights was by default real time, right? Like it didn't automatically pause. You could set it up to automatically pause at the end of every turn and then sort of queue up commands and then go, but by default, and I'll tell you what, like as a fighter, that was fine because there was enough time in between turns. You could say, this is the target that I'm going to attack. You know, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to let my NPCs do their thing automatically. But as a cleric, it's like, oh my God, I have 75 spells to choose from, right? Like I have to pause.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you had never played the Dragon Age games, right?
I have not, no.
Okay. I would recommend you try Dragon Age Origins at some point.
Okay.
It's very much that. Like, I mean, it's a D&D-ish type system, not D&D. Again, it was BioWare being like, okay, we're not going to do Baldur's Gate now. We're doing Mass Effect instead of Star Wars. Let's do Dragon Age instead of D&D.
Right.
And the first game in particular felt like the sweet spot. I think the second game and even the third game felt a little bit like action RPG.
Mm-hmm.
The first game still had that sort of default real-time-ish aspect, and then you could pull into a tactical mode and pause and do stuff that way. Worth playing.
Okay.
It's one of those games that I go back and replay once every 4 or 5 years, just because it's fantastic.
I enjoyed Diablo 3 a lot, too, and that's on that sort of fast end of things a bit where everything is always happening and you've got to make decisions. One of the things I think we've talked about this before too about game design is that if you're going to do something where you're making actions in a hurry, it makes sense to have a sort of slow period beforehand where you choose, these are the actions that I'm going to have available, and there should be like 5 or 6 of them. at most.
Yeah, that style of game doesn't appeal to me too much. And I know I'm the oddball here because that MOBA genre is one of the biggest genres in gaming, from Dota to League of Legends to whatever the Blizzard one was, Heroes of the Storm. It felt like Fisher-Price MMO. And I found the same thing playing Guild Wars 2. I never played the first Guild Wars, really. I know you guys were into it a fair bit. But coming from World of Warcraft and then getting into Guild Wars 2, and it's like, oh, I've got an action bar and it's got, what, 4 or 5 slots.
Yep.
That's it.
The strategy comes before you start. Your strategy is choosing those 5 buttons.
Mm-hmm. There's something to be said for that sort of strategy, but it also took a lot of the meta out of the game. Like my favorite version of World of Warcraft was, I've mentioned Burning Crusade, but not only were you worried about which spell you were casting, but which spell level you were casting it at, so that you were working on like mana efficiency. Like playing a Holy Paladin in Burning Crusade, you'd have like 6-8 different levels of like flash of light on your bar. You'd be watching your mana and you'd be upranking or downranking based on efficiency and how much mana you were regenning at the time and sort of healing throughput that you needed. Or same with your sort of longer big heal, you'd have several ranks of that out. I really enjoyed that. And unfortunately, it was right after that I tried to get into other things like Guild Wars 2 or Dota, League of Legends, that kind of stuff. And it just felt so baby's first MMO to me.
But at the same time, like there's two ends to approach that from.
Oh, sure.
Because on the one hand, like not everybody's going to enjoy, you know, like, okay, so I have a spreadsheet of my spells and when I should use them, wherever. Absolutely not. Right. Cause there's Eve for that, which I never got into because I looked at it and went, no. Just no. I mean, I have to look at spreadsheets at work all day. I don't need to play a game where I need spreadsheets as well. As I've gotten older as well, I've gotten to appreciate simpler gameplay ideas. Because, I mean, I played EverQuest for a while, and the only reason that I stayed with EverQuest as long as I did was because I was really familiar with it. So I didn't have to do a lot of thinking and planning. It's like, is this an upgrade? Yes, it is. Is it a really big upgrade? I know what it's worth. I don't have to, right? The first time that I played through on the way through again on one of the classic servers, like I had spreadsheets of like stats versus cost versus this versus material versus time in versus what have I got versus how much of an upgrade it is, you know. And as time went on, it became like, it's really not that important. Like the upgrades and the gains are so marginal that if it's just a little bit of an upgrade, good enough, you know. It's fine. My approach to life has changed in that way too as I've gotten older, right? You go from like everything has to be maximized to good enough is good enough, you know?
It's worth saying with those types of games that I tried to get into and just bounced off of, I recognized that the strategy in those games was elsewhere, right? They were closer to a real-time strategy game, you know? Positioning, understanding sort of the game's current meta, basic tactics, I guess. I mean, sometimes they play just more like a tower defense game, right? You know, it's lane defend it.
I love tower defense games so much because, again, like my joy comes from the planning and the setup and seeing how well did that plan work. So as you said, like there's just different people, you know. I don't want to yuck anybody's yum. If they like it, great. It's important that we recognize that not everything is going to be for us.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as we get older, everything is not going to be for us.
Almost nothing is for us, which makes Baldur's Gate 3 even more of a miracle. Because not only is it for them, but it is also for us.
And it's a nice signal that, you know what? It doesn't have to be for them or us. It can be for all of us.
That doesn't apply to all games, but
no,
you know,
no.
Sometimes it can.
I don't think that I could ever get into Fortnite. I don't care what kind of changes you make. I don't think Fortnite is ever going to be my thing. Although there was one I saw the other day that I was like, that looks really interesting. And I can't remember what the heck it was, but it was something a little bit like Fortnite or what's the one where you drop out of the airplane and you got to thank the bus driver before you get out. And then the map shrinks.
That's all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first one that really went mainstream was PUBG or PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Yes.
Fortnite was like the builder game that saw the Battle Royale formula and success of PUBG and said, oh, we could do that, but with our slick cartoony look and stuff, and blew up bigger than sort of PUBG ever did. But there's been a few variations on that formula now. I mean, fuck, I think every Call of Duty has a Battle Royale mode in it now. I haven't played a Call of Duty mainstream game in a million years, but
I think the Modern Warfare 3 I might have played. That might be the you know, cutscene, the game.
The first Modern Warfare 3 or the second Modern Warfare 3, because they're just using the same names again.
I don't know. Did you see there's a Chucky TV show? There's a TV show, like Chucky, the doll, the horror show.
Yeah, yeah. I want to say I saw something about that, but nah.
I mean, it came up as a preview as we were watching Elementary tonight. And I'm just like, what? And I looked over, I've been watching a lot of Red Letter Media in the last day or two. I got all caught up on the last Best of the Worst, and they did Andor, which was a really interesting retrospective or review. But I looked over at Cindy and I said, you know, it's gotten to the point where whenever somebody in movies or TV shows or whatever has an original idea, I don't even care if it's good or not. I'm just happy they tried something new. You know, like, his remakes are nice and everything, and it's nice to pull on the nostalgia string from time to time, but like, let's face it, Dukes of Hazzard, the new movie reboot from probably 10 years ago now, would have been a much better movie if they had just not bothered to make it Dukes of Hazzard and just made it some Southern boys in a car running from the sheriff. Like, it would have been a better movie because it wasn't Dukes of Hazzard.
No.
Or the A-Team. I mean,
I didn't mind that A-Team movie. Honestly, I quite enjoyed it.
I thought it was a fine movie. It did not need to be the A-Team. The only reason they called it the A-Team was so that they could put A-Team on the posters and, you know, fellas of our age would go, I remember the A-Team.
I don't know. I've come to a realization as I'm older. I don't know what people's resistance is to going back and watching the old stuff. So let's use the A-Team as an example. If you really liked the A-Team, why do you need new A-Team when you could just go back and watch old A-Team? It's easier than it's ever been to watch that shit. But if you liked it, not, you know, oh, you've got some member berries and rose-colored nostalgia goggles on 24/7. Like, you just mentioned Elementary. I mean, we just rewatched that again, start to finish, for probably the fifth time, because we liked the show. And it's not, you know, 40 years old or anything like some of the other shows we might talk about. But
still a good show.
Yeah, and there's lots of new shows that we could be watching, but it's like, actually, you know what? We'd like this show.
Yeah.
And we have zero hesitancy about rewatching something. I was thinking about this when we were, because Red Letter Media, you mentioned them, and they were talking about the Ghostbusters movie.
Yep.
And, you know, they're talking about bringing everybody into the Ghostbusters movie. And it was this, you know, you got the old Ghostbusters, the new Ghostbusters, and they really need to sort of condense it, distill it down to something that is interesting. But my thought about that is, you know what? Really good movie? The original Ghostbusters movie.
And it's a great movie.
It holds up. Like, you can watch it today and it's as good as it was when you watched it the first time.
I find that movies from that era are, speaking of, we watched Oppenheimer. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
It was a good movie. But I think I've mentioned this before too. We went back and tried to watch the original Ocean's 11.
Mm-hmm.
And watching stuff from that era and watching stuff from the original Ghostbusters era, and Oppenheimer did this as well. And it's one of the reasons that I think it didn't resonate with a lot of younger viewers, has a completely different rhythm. Right? Everything is slowed down and everything has import and impact, but it doesn't give you the action beats that you're expecting. Mm-hmm. And that's off-putting because if you look at a lot of modern media, it's we have a formula, we know it works, and we know people like it. And this is not me complaining about a formula. Having a formula is fine. We know it works and we know people like it. Why would we deviate from that? And because we have so much more media now, like I think we've mentioned before, like I remember when I was a kid, like there was a movie theater and it had a movie and it was there for like 6 weeks or 2 months, right? Summer blockbusters were a thing because this was the movie that you're going to get to see this summer. So like you're inundated with all of these things that are like sort of the same thing repackaged with different colors, right? You know, you like it, you know, you're going to like it because it's the same as the last thing that you liked. So when you try and go back and watch those things, like I can only imagine for people who are, you know, in their early 20s, trying to go back and watch the original Ghostbusters, it's going to be the most boring thing they've ever seen because it's a different rhythm.
Right. But my issue with that is that you don't have to make a new Ghostbusters movie for those people. They're not nostalgic for the old Ghostbusters. No. And the people that are nostalgic for it, you're just disappointing by giving them something that isn't what they want. They can go back and watch the first Ghostbusters movie.
Absolutely, they can. I think the drive for the people who are making that new Ghostbusters movie is, hey, you know, all of the people who like the original Ghostbusters movie have already bought it on Betamax and VHS and DVD and HD DVD and Blu-ray, and they have it on their streaming service. We can't sell it to them anymore. Mm-hmm. We need something new to sell them. And if we package it in something that they're familiar with, then they'll buy it. But we also want to appeal to a new generation of people. So we have to make it for them about the stuff that the old people are also going to like. Right. And I think probably they would find more success by just continually making new things that people want. But it's really hard to convince people to do something new and different. That's the way we've always done it. So we're going to do it that way again. Especially because, I mean, a movie costs $1 billion. You can't not make a profit.
I don't know. They seem to be doing a pretty good job of not making a profit and tax shenanigans and all that shit.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah. Hey, do you want to do some table talk?
Sure.
Are we playing this weekend?
I am planning on it. I was going to send a notification out today and I forgot, so I will send one out tomorrow. I'm hoping to. I have to admit that I took a long weekend last weekend. I took 4 days off and I thought, I'll get some stuff prepared. And I literally laid still for 4 days. Right. Coming off of basically 3 weeks of working, you know, 60-hour weeks, 7 days a week. So, yeah. I spent the whole weekend just staring at the ceiling. So it depends on how much I get prepped tomorrow, honestly.
Just throw an encounter at us. It's fine. I know that's basically what last session was, but whatever.
Kind of. I mean, there was some plot movement last time.
There was. It was an encounter with somebody significant around the edges, but.
And it filled a lot more time than I was anticipating. So, yeah, I thought you guys did really well.
Hmm. My game has been basically that I mentioned, I don't know, the last time we recorded. For context, if you're listening to this, we recorded a episode a week and a half ago, maybe almost 2 weeks ago. And I still haven't got around to starting to edit it yet. It's been an insane week and a bit for me. Well, we've made the transition now to being full remote and there's just been some crazy shit going on at work, both related and unrelated to that. Anyway, I mentioned that I'd done started a dungeon crawl and mentioned that I was getting into some puzzles. And it wasn't something that I did with my group very often, and it was fantastic. I prepped stuff more than a month ago that they're still working on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically two map sort of dungeon crawl thing. Half of it, I'm reusing the map that I ran you guys through that was like a Thieves' Guildy type thing in a like a cistern underground cistern sewery type thing where you dealt with Fist and his lackeys. I'm reusing that map, and there was a whole second part of that that you guys didn't get to see that was sort of like a maze testy type thing that I ran them through, lots of traps, lots of yada yada. So they're still going through it, and it's still going great. They're enjoying themselves. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying that I haven't had to sort of run and keep pace with them to do some prep. We had a perfect moment happen, a perfect D&D moment. Not last session, but the session before. I'd worked them into this room, which was basically a room that would fill with water. Like it was a water trap type room. I think when I spoke to you last, I'd mentioned that like there was a big lever in the middle of it and they had no reservations about pulling it. Mm-hmm. They pull it, you know, the door is shut, water starts to rise. And I had a couple of like medium to high CR basilisks sort of in the water underneath them that would be able to come out as the room filled up. And two things happened that were just perfect. One of the players decided to take advantage of something that I'd given them. And I always like when players remember that I've given them shit in the past and they're like, oh, I have this cape or whatever it is, this item that allows me to cast Dimension Door. Mm-hmm. And she with Dimension Door, you don't have to have line of sight. You just need to be able to visualize it. They'd come through an identical door to get into the room as what's on the other side of the room. So just imagine a big like bank vault style door with big sort of locking mechanism on the other side. And she's like, rather than fight these basilisks, I will use this Dimension Door. I will take another person with me, the big strong guy, the barbarian. I'm going to shoop to the other side as this room's filling up with water and save my friends while the other two are dealing with these basilisks. And the issue was, is it took them a while to get the door unlocked. And then it's like when you know, accidentally drive your car into the lake, right? Like you need to break the windows to be able to get the door open. So they had to struggle with that for a little while. So it actually took them out of the encounter while being clever. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the two that were in the room fighting these basilisks were just, they were getting their asses handed to them, but they realized there was like an underwater mechanism for opening this door. So they had like a plan A and plan B going. And then they really hadn't engaged in melee with the basilisks. And the one thing that these particular monsters had is if you hit them and you're in melee range, they have sort of this secretion that basically, if you fail your saving throw, you get turned to stone. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, my players are high enough level that one of them has greater restoration already. The one of a couple of different things, but the most optimal situation for dealing with petrification. She was the one, as druid, that decided, as things are getting ugly, I'm going to shapeshift into this big giant turtle thing. I'm going to go and get in melee combat with these to try and save my friend. And she was the one that got petrified. So the other player that was in the room started off as like a bard blood hunter multi-class.
Okay.
So lycanthrope blood hunter, which is a Matt Mercer homebrew thing. And decided she wanted to start taking levels in cleric. Just thematically, it worked with where her character was sort of going and shit that had happened in our game. And she's really been playing up this cleric thing. She's trying to establish a relationship with, you know, like a god she can't talk to. That's just, she doesn't even know if it's real.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like, it's just, I want to believe that this is real. And she's done a few things with her character that have suggested that, okay, there's something out there that at least is sort of answering her call. But she had nothing in her regular toolkit to deal with petrification. Mm-hmm. So she decided that she was just going to pray as hard as she possibly could to this god that maybe doesn't even exist. And she rolled a nat 20 on a religion roll. So through her through her efforts, I allowed them to cast Greater Restoration as basically a level one cleric, level two cleric maybe now, because of the multi-class, just for, like, I made her role play it out. You're not just going to say, I'm going to pray really hard. I want to hear you praying really hard to this god. Like, what are you saying? Let me hear how much you want it. Then give me the roll. Nat 20. It was fantastic. So she got to save the day, realized that there was a lever just down sort of near the water as the other people were just finishing off with the door and trying to get it open. And then she pulled the lever. The door swung open, flushed everybody else that was at the door behind it down the hallway hundreds of feet into the next area. They didn't defeat the basilisks. They just survived long enough to get the door open and get the hell out of Dodge. And it was fantastic. Like, it couldn't have worked any better. If all four of them had been in the room, they probably would have handled the basilisks fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two of them would be difficult for two characters, especially if they're getting in melee.
Yeah, and they're like CR 7, I think was a stat block. They're all level 9s, but two CR 7s with mechanics that intentionally make it hard to engage them.
Yeah.
The barbarian who's resistant to everything. Nope, he's behind the door bashing locks. The rogue that's dipped into wizard that does almost entirely ranged damage. Yeah, she's behind the locks. The druid and this bard cleric blood hunter swimming in a room full of water was fantastic.
Jack of all trades, yeah.
Oh, it was great. I loved it. They loved it. They've said that it's honestly one of the best sessions they've enjoyed, which is nice because, you know, like I spend so much time and effort trying to build strong narrative shit and they really eat that up too. But it is nice to know that I can just throw a dungeon crawl at them, you know, like they're enjoying the mechanical aspect of the game as much as the storytelling aspect of the game.
Which is a big thing because it does. I mean, there are multiple pillars of adventure, right?
There are. And I have, I set them up coming into the area. They're basically walking into Mordor, so to speak. So I'm like, I told them difficulty is going to ramp up while you're here. And they've found the sweet spot between like trying not to meta that and be ultra cautious and sticking to the bit and allowing stupid, silly shit to happen while dealing with more dangerous shit. Hey, let's split the party. If you're really thinking about it, you'd be like, oh, this would be a terrible idea.
Yep. It's tough. It's tough to let things like we're so conditioned that we have to win, that we have to find the optimal outcome, that we have to optimize every solution, that it's tough to just go, I mean, I'm going to do a thing and let the chips fall where they may, you know, and hope it works out. And that's, again, that's one of the reasons that having an actual dungeon master makes the game special. Because if you were to do that in like a computer simulation, you'd get wrecked. It would be just over. You're leaving a character behind and they're going to die, which is a thing that used to happen in, you know, games that I played in all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, bring a stack of bards because you're going to die.
And not to talk about Baldur's Gate 3 again, but it is really probably the only time I've seen a video game that actually even touched the level of failing forward that you can get playing a TTRPG.
It's amazing. There's only a couple of places. So I'm playing on honor mode, right? And I'm actually in Baldur's Gate now. Well, sorry, I'm not. I just got the Baldur's Gate waypoint. I'm in Rivington. I'm starting to work on the murder mystery. But I went through that scene that I complained bitterly about where you meet the emperor, and I'm playing as a Githyanki. Right. So you get to the thing and he's like, you must trust me. I'm the one who's been manipulating your mind all this time. I'm on your side. Like, are you really? Like, I can't. There's no way I can trust you. I can't trust you. Right. So I made the choice to say, no, I'm not going to help you. I'm not on your side. So he becomes hostile. Right. And I'm like, oh, great. I just tanked my honor mode run because I'm like role playing as my character. But then, you know, you're still actually fighting the other Gith in the place. So once you knock them out, he becomes friendly and you have the dialogue afterwards, right? And his basically way to wrangle the situation is to say, it's good you came to your senses. It's like, no, not really. I just recognized that they were a greater threat than you were. So, you know, now here we are, and I guess we're uneasy allies, and that's fine. But that's, I mean, that was a tough narrative thing to do. But it is, as you say, like, it's a really good way to fail forward, which is honestly is hard to do as a DM as well. Like, trying to program that into a computer game must have been an absolute nightmare.
I'm excited.
Yeah? Any spoilers?
No.
Damn it.
Yes, but no. No spoilers as to the idea. I am stoked for the idea. It's going to be a lot of fun, I think. When we were talking about it last, I said that I wanted to go sort of old school paper, pencils, no real digital aids. Like, I might need to pull out a table or something on my phone at some point. But I've prepped my DM kit. Got all my shit in it ready to go. My screen is set up. My paper token standy things that I've made are all set up and ready to go. And then I decided I want more.
Okay.
I want to do some of the stuff that I have a hard time doing in a virtual tabletop. Things like verticality.
Mm-hmm.
Things like movement. Things like...
Oh, you're building terrain.
I'm not putting any effort really into it. It's not quality. It's literally just cut up pieces of foam stacked and painted. I might do a dry brushing on it to just make it look a little bit better, but I'm not trying to make something that like I would keep and bust out for multiple games. It's mostly just, I wanted to do something, but I've got that going. I've decided it's going to be two set piece type thing. Mm. Right. So one of them is going to be sort of a fun kind of encounter thing going on. The other one is going to be an encounter thing too, but I wanted to introduce some wackiness and movement and something special like about the physical space. So I'm in the middle of building something.
Oh, okay. It's a code wheel.
No, but it's something. We'll see how it goes. I'm not sure yet until I finish it whether it's going to work out the way I want it to work out. I don't want it to bog things down. I just want it to be different than playing in the virtual tabletop where it's like, oh, I move my token six squares this way and I do something. And I move my token six squares this way and I do something.
Have you ever played a game called Labyrinth? It's a board game by, I think it's Ravensburger, but it's a board as a normal board game. You fold it out. It's like 18 inches by 18 inches or so. And it's got all of these little sort of 2-inch by 2-inch tiles, some of which are affixed to the board and some of which you place in random patterns, right? And there's one square that doesn't fit on the board. And the shtick is each of your persons, your meeples start in a corner, right? And before you move, and they all have a path printed on them. So there's, you know, you can go this way and that way, but not that way because there's a wall there. Before you can actually move to pick up the thing that you need to pick up on the board, you have to insert your tile, shift an entire row of tiles, and the other one comes off the other side. Right. So the whole thing is constantly shifting and moving and you have to try and figure out, okay, if I do that, then I can get over there to pick up the thing that I need. Anyway, I'll show you when you come up because it's a fun game to play.
That's kind of what I'm going for. I have a holy grail and it is not really a pun intended here, but sort of a pun intended because it's wrong movie. I want to, at some point in my life, run an encounter that recreates, not actually recreates the scene, but in principle recreates a kind of energy of the minecart chase in Temple of Doom.
Okay.
So if I were to run this in person, like you could do a couple of things where, you know, you got two carts that are running in parallel. And in addition to whatever your other kit of materials are, you know, you could do something to try and speed up the cart, slow the cart so that they're dynamically shifting and moving relative to each other. Just as another aspect of you using the environment to your benefit, but also reacting to the changes in the environment, right? Mm-hmm. And without spending a ton of time prepping a scene in a virtual tabletop to try and allow you to do stuff with moving tiles and shit. And I've tried with limited success to do that kind of shit in the past. It's just so much easier to do that when you can just have something physical that you can just give it a little push, right?
Yes.
Now, that's not quite what I'm doing here. I mean, I'll give away the mechanics a little bit. Sort of four-tiered circles. These are floors.
Okay. And
they're going to be walls built onto them.
Right.
And each of these are going to rotate independently of each other.
Okay.
An encounter is going to happen here, so I should probably be not standing way away from my mic, but an encounter is going to happen, and during the turn order, I'm going to change the state of this. I'll have you roll some dice. I'm not sure what the frequency will be yet, but depending on how the dice roll goes, these are going to rotate. That's going to open up some passages, close up other passages, change the position of you relative to the people that you're fighting, could separate you from somebody that you're trying to get to heal. It could, you know, there's a lot of things that could happen.
Right.
I don't want it to be, you know, like, I don't want to waste time doing it. I want something that's just, okay, you roll some dice. It's basically going to be like a clock with 8 points on it, representing, right, you know, basically all your sort of 45 degrees. You'll roll this is number 4. You'll roll a 3, and you'll just point that at that direction.
Okay.
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm thinking with that.
That'll be interesting.
I hope so.
It's going to be interesting to watch because it's... Cindy and I have been building some things. Nothing serious, like basically bookshelf style of things, right? And I spend every day, all day, figuring out things in three dimensions. My most recent thing was building a set of scaffolding around the house that Jack built. And it has to, you know, do certain things, and it's going to fit through here, but not through there, and do that, but be the, honestly, all of that stuff. So I think in sort of like three dimensions and going through space a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy doesn't. And it's really interesting to, when we start to discuss things where I'm describing something that to me is entirely obvious, mm-hmm, right? And for Cindy, it's just like, it's a black box. Like, I don't understand. As soon as she sees it, she's like, oh, okay, I get it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying she's not clever. She's very clever. This is just something that doesn't work in her mind. So it'll be interesting to watch people as they look at this and somebody gets it. And it's like, oh, okay, so this is likely to happen, and someone else is going to be like, now what? Right? Because that's human nature, is that some people are just like, oh, yeah, that's obvious, and other people are going to be like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Like math.
Yep. And, you know, in my mind, like, I'm envisioning something like a 4 versus 4, 4 versus 6 encounter on this board that's spread out. So you might be engaged with somebody who's one level down from you, like they're just steps, right? And then they move out, and then somebody else moves in, or you get cut off and you have to do something else, or you have to move a different way, or you're trying to get to this thing, right? And it should just be a straight line, but it's a moving maze in front of you without being a moving maze. Like, you think of that scene in the Dungeons and Dragons movie where they're sort of in the big stadium and the maze is moving. Now, that was a literal maze. And yes, there was kind of some encounter stuff that was happening mixed in. This is meant to be less of a, like, the maze isn't the point. The maze is just sort of the flavor and obstacle that you're trying to overcome while dealing with the other thing.
It's going to be a little bit like WrestleMania 7.
Maybe.
Yeah, tag in, tag out, tag up.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes. It may fall flat, but it shouldn't be like a long enough thing that even if it doesn't hit like I want it to hit, we'll get past it and move on to the other thing.
Yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, I'm honestly, like, it's funny because the game, like, when we're playing online, the game is so much about the game. Right. And it's wonderful. Like, it's great because it's a great game, and it's a like a narrative experience. The in-person game is so different because there's so much more like side shit going on. There's so much more, you know, like the group that I originally started playing with. I mean, 90% of our gaming time was Monty Python and Simpsons quotes,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, how can we relate something from a movie or a TV show we're all familiar with to the situation that's happening yeah. now?
And the one shot that I'm running, and it's going to spoil it a little, I imagine you'll guess what I'm doing. Like, it's designed around inside joke.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. It's all an inside joke.
That's exactly what it should be. Yeah. And assuming we're probably going to have someone coming, because I think, I don't know if Cindy mentioned that we are thinking about inviting one of my friends from up here.
Yeah, he's been invited and has confirmed.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, he's a like an OG player. He probably hasn't played Dungeons and Dragons since Advanced Dungeons and Dragons was a new thing, which is going to be great. So it will be fun if it's all an inside joke for him to be outside of the joke. And he will roll with it really well.
It will be a platform for us to tell stories about
yes.
shit that's happened in the past and share the inside joke.
I mean, that's Dungeons and Dragons, right? It's the inside joke that you can share with anyone who wants to come inside.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the inside of the joke.
Anyway, that's all I'm going to tell you. I'm looking forward to running it. I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. I'm looking forward to just playing D&D a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great time. You know, and I'm old enough that I won't remember it the following weekend, so...
Are we playing the Saturday afternoon? I don't know what the itinerary is.
I have no idea. I don't know, man. It's my 50th birthday party. I'm not planning it.
No, it sounds like your wife had it pretty much nailed down. She was confirming like breakfast recipes and stuff for the Sunday. It was great.
I love my wife. I really, really do. But there are times when she says to me, I'm just so tired. And I'm like, gosh, I wonder why. She has the entire, like, if you put her in charge of something, it's a lock. It's going to happen. It's going to come off without a hitch. There are going to be no surprises. Everything is going to be planned. Everything is going to be confirmed.
There will be marks on the floor where you're supposed to stand.
Yeah. I mean, and it's one of those things that, like, when she does the things that's a good fit for, like, it's beautiful to see.
Mm-hmm.
There are some parts of life that are just normally chaos.
You need to turn that off and just go with it. And so I imagine it's hard.
It's very hard. Well, and it's the same for me because I am, and we've talked about this before. Like, I'm not good at planning stuff. I'm really good at improvising things. Like, I will figure out what we're doing on the day of and then do it. And it doesn't come off as flawlessly as when Cindy plans stuff because improvising doesn't work like that. You need everyone to improvise when that mm-hmm. happens. Not everybody's good at it. But I have a real hard time planning things ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the way that we're built. And it's one of the reasons that Cindy and I like fit so well together. Because I will encourage her to just let it happen. Whatever. If it's okay to fail. Right? That has become in my older years, or in the last few years anyway, is become my mantra. It's okay to fail. Right? Like, I've probably mentioned this before too, but this is some really good life advice that I was given a few years ago. I was going in to talk to my boss about something that I was really nervous about. Basically, I was going in to give my boss shit. It's like, I'm unhappy. You're doing something wrong and I want to tell you about it. I had acid in my stomach. I was all stressed out. And I had a coworker who said to me, like, what's the worst that can happen? Seriously, think about what's the worst thing that can happen. Right. And in my mind at that time and in the place I was, it was like, I could get fired. And he's like, and can you live with that? Like, if that's what the outcome of this meeting is, can you live with that? Well, yeah. I mean, I can find another job. So what are you worried about? Right. And there's times when the worst outcome obviously is something that you can't deal with and you have to adjust for that. But for most social situations and for most things that we do, what's the worst that can happen? I don't know. You say something embarrassing, your pants fall down. Can you live with that? So what are you worried about? It's okay to fail. That's the wisdom that I find at the bottom of a can of beer.
It's the wisdom I find at the bottle of tequila.
Good God, man. You know what? I was going to suggest that we do two of these tonight, but I don't think you can survive a second one.
Actually, I haven't had too much. Maybe 3-4 ounces. Not too bad. Enough. Yeah,
enough
that I'm probably done.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, we did pretty good for having more or less nothing to talk about.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have a parting gift on the dock, but I do have something that I would like to share before we say goodnight.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Anybody want a peanut?
You've already seen it.
I have.
I've been cutting shapes out of cardboard. I've been slapping paint on what is essentially recycling. And I have to tell you, when I make things, usually I'm trying to make things well, right? Huh? I'll be designing something to print out on the 3D printer, and it's like, okay, I need to do exact measurements here, and I need to make a seatbelt thing to protect so the dog can't accidentally unclick the seatbelt while she's in the back of the car because she's got a strap that clips into it. Shit like that. It's like, I need to do this right. And it's been a long time since I've had kids the age where I would sit down and do crafts and stuff with them. And because I haven't played D&D in person in 9 million years, while I watch a lot of videos about people that do like terrain and do mini stuff and all of that, it's really not something that I've actually physically dabbled in. I've just kind of consumed it as entertainment. I bought some paint at the dollar store, some dollar store paint brushes. I've been hacking up a box that I've had in storage for my TV downstairs. I've been gluing some shit together. I've spent no money. Like, you know, here's $4.50 worth of paint. I bought a $2 glue gun because I couldn't find mine. And I've been enjoying the shit out of it. It's been so long since I've done anything where it's just like, that's good enough. I mean, it's cardboard. I don't care. I'm making something. It spins. It does what I need it to do, or it stands up, or, you know, even just making standees, since we're not going to actually have proper minis or anything like that. It's been fun.
Yeah.
And if you're old like we are and you're not into crafting, take a weekend, hack up some cardboard, make something. Doesn't have to be perfect. Better if it isn't.
It's okay to fail.
It's okay to fail. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good enough. That is my parting gift. Get some paint on your hands. Get some glue on your hair. Don't cut yourself.
Glue is delicious.
Probably not the stuff that comes out of the dollar store glue gun that I bought.
Oh my God, no. No, nor you should not be drinking PVA glue either. I mean, it's toxic. Please don't do it. Also, Tide Pods. They look delicious. They're not.
I was close to doing Tide Pods with my tequila. It was that or, you know, this aspartame-filled Pepsi Lime. So could have gone either way.
The amount of microplastics we eat on a daily basis, I'm not sure that aspartame is really the worst thing anymore.
It really isn't. Nope. Well, it's been good talking to you, man.
And you. And I really enjoyed your parting gift. It's exactly the kind of thing that it should be. You are drunk as fuck.